This morning we're going to continue with our series in James, and so if you have your insert, you can pull that out. And the first chapter, James had led us through a discussion that addresses that we can stand in confidence. When we are truly a follower of Christ, that there's nothing that can push us off of that. There's nothing that we really have something to fear. We can face challenges both from within and without with the word from above. We have the perfect law, who is ultimately Christ, to mirror our lives after and to pursue things with abandon in life. And so in light of that, he moves on into verse 2 to talk about what do we do? We serve, we engage with a sense of understanding. And so we explored last week, that with this great command that Jesus had gave us to love one another. What does that mean, and why is it so important? And so we're supposed to have this sense of serving one another with some understanding, not evaluating one another with the outward appearance and resources and things like that, but just through God's eyes. And so today he picks up on that. The passage today, remember that this was written as a letter. There's no chapter divisions and verses and things like that to the original reader. This was just a letter. And so he continues on to say, hey, we love each other because works mean something, and works come out of something deeper. And he's going to bring us to what I think is the climax of this verse, the most important verse in the entire book. Belief translates into action. Did you actually do something with your life? And just sitting here singing some songs and making ourselves feel good is one thing. That's important to come together as a community, but we're actually supposed to be a people of action. Our faith is supposed to engage with the greater engine of what God's doing, and so our faith is to be in gear. Deeds, acts, behaviors, thoughts, words, things are all to come together for a reason, and that's called mature faith. Today we're going to be looking at how maturing faith requires action. And so if you're a person who kind of just likes doing the church thing and it's one of those requirements on what it looks like to be a good standing member in the community, that's not faith at all. Maturing faith is one that is put into action and is engaged in something. And you know, there's the story of the church not living up to that at all. A few years ago, actually a number of years ago, I used to be really involved with camp, and one of some of the kids that I would, you know, interact with a lot, I really got to know their dad. And Rob and I were friends, a little older than I am, but we did a lot of fun stuff together, played a lot of practical jokes on each other, and so he was just kind of a neat guy that I hung out with. Well, one time I was driving in the city, and I was going onto an on-ramp onto the freeway, and I noticed his car in front of me. And so I was like, hey, I know Rob, and so I noticed that he wasn't driving and his daughter was driving. So I pulled up behind them and I just waited. And of course, she's going a little slower. She was all of, I don't know, 17 at the time. And so she's driving really slow. So I got onto the freeway, turned and passed him. And as I went by, I waved. And the exact same time I waved, I looked over and I saw this. And it was, oops. He waved at me and showed me how long his middle finger was. And it was because, later I figured out, is he thought I was some guy just tailing his daughter. And he got really upset at that and expressed his emotion to this guy who was tailing his daughter. So at the exact same time, I looked over and waved, and the exact same time his finger came across was the horror on his daughter's face, realizing, Dad, that's Chris! And, you know, by that time, to see his reaction, I had passed. So when I got in front of him, I looked in my rearview mirror, and of course, he was red and laughing and so on. And so it became a joke for quite a while. So when we're outside of the context, hey, our actions speak quite loudly, and people see it for what it is. Unfortunately, over the years, I have lost touch with Rob, but I also lost confidence in Rob and in some of his behaviors and some of the things that went on, and really some of the, I guess, how his life has translated from that time until now. In the two churches that I was strongly involved in growing up and certainly influenced by, as I've gotten older and people's lives have flushed out, it has been very discouraging to realize that there was no maturing faith there because their deeds have proven really the orientation of their heart. And that's what's been difficult for me as a person who's got to know those who had a huge impact on my life, but realize now what was really beneath the surface. And after all of these years of festering, what has happened to their marriages, to their ministries, to their workplaces. And it's discouraging. And so James speaks into that kind of situation that says maturing faith actually translates into action, and action for the duration. That, you know, we're not just like this here today and like this everywhere else. But actually our maturing faith translates into actions that's consistent with our beliefs. And so James is going to speak into that, that your faith actually does something. And the situation he's speaking into is that, hey, Satan delights in the church's false claims of faith. So another great warm opening statement like last week. Last week, I think I called you snobs. And today I'm saying, hey, we're delighting Satan. You can just imagine what I'm preparing for next week, right? These are situations that are very real. Now, why would I say something like this? You know, Satan loves to lull us into apathy. He loves for us to come and do our church thing and sit here and listen to maybe a great sermon and to you forget it a few hours from now. Just not speak of it again and think of it again and show up again next week and do it all over again. For us to get stuck in a rut. For us to fight about things that don't really matter, like, you know, where should the pulpit be, and can we move the piano, and what color should the walls be, and should that kind of person be able to dress like that, or whatever we often fight about. You know, for people to be stuck in fear that I can't even say anything when we're actually formally congregated together. I can talk to everybody individually, but I would never say something if we're all together. We're just gripped by fear. And I never tell anybody else about what I actually say I believe. I mean, Satan just delights in the church being the way that most of the Western church is. I've got them because they're not being who they're called to be. They're not doing their deeds. Yeah, they're not doing, you know, all this really gross stuff we see in the Middle East or whatever, but you know what? They're not doing what God created them to do, and he's delighting in it. Why would I say that? What is James speaking into? Well, if you haven't turned yet, James chapter 2, verse 14 is where we're looking at. And James challenges and says, what good is it, brothers, if a man claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save him? You know, the church always has this challenge of momentary conviction. I mean, maybe here right now, something's plucking your heart things and like, oh yeah, maybe this is resonating with me a little bit. But, you know, you've been here how many times and gone through that same process, and by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it's just this fleeting memory. We have these moments of conviction where we maybe raise our hands or we sing out loud or we say some big prayer or we're being convicted to do something in particular, but it's just momentary. It doesn't really translate into long-term deeds, and that's really what James is talking about. What good is it if we claim to have faith and in the right moment when the emotion's taken over, but it doesn't translate into anything? Any works, any behaviors, any thoughts, any words, anything that makes a difference in the world. We're gripped by these energized songs or lofty prayers or right words from a speaker or moments of conviction or maybe on a high in a weekend or something like that. But then the churches more have been defined by this prolonged stagnancy. Prolonged stagnancy where it doesn't do anything. We sit in our pews and we throw a few bucks in the offering plate when it goes by, and you know, we wash tables, or we set up chairs, or we throw some potlucks, and we swing a hammer once in a while, but that's all we do. And God has painted a picture of a movement that can't be stopped, and if we're not a part of that movement, we're stale, and ultimately, which means we're dying. And so now, more than ever, probably in history, you see these churches up for sale. Churches closing, ceasing to exist in communities that are desperate for strong churches. And so as a result, we see a deadly faith. James says, can such a faith save you? Does it save anybody? Does it bring life to anything? No. Workless faith is worthless faith. It's unproductive. It's sterile. It's barren. It's ineffectual. It's dead. You know, we had a couple of prayers about the safety that we enjoy here in Canada to do this. And we had a prayer about the persecuted church. And, you know, every part of the world, except for parts of the Western world, death is a daily reality. You can walk down the street and see a dead body. You know, somebody in your family has died within the year, and you've actually had them laying in your house. Death is a reality to most of the world. And so they understand the stench of this. This resonates with its readers that faith is dead, and they know what dead means. But we're in our culture, there's such a filter that we don't face it, we don't smell it, we don't see it, we don't hear it. When we take death seriously, we see that this is a big problem, that workless faith is no faith at all. It is dead. It can't save anybody, including us. So I've made a bold claim here that Satan delights in the apathy of the church. And in my Sabbath day this week on Monday, I was really hit again about some of the challenges in this book. That in this book it says that probably many people sitting in church today will not be a part of God's future kingdom. Now, I'm not making that conclusion about anybody in particular, but that's what this book says. Because if we look at Matthew chapter 7, Jesus talks about the wide gate and the narrow gate. The wide is the road to destruction that people go down, but very narrow is the road to life. And very few actually find it. Very few. Matthew goes on to say, you know, a wise builder is one that goes down that narrow road, but a foolish one builds his house on the sand. A foolish one is who hears the stuff and doesn't do anything about it. And of course, it all falls apart. He goes on to say in Matthew chapter 24 that the church, as we would define it, it consists of wheat and tares, and God is going to filter it out. And only a few on the narrow road, only those that are actually reproducing something, are going to be a part of God's kingdom. Wow, a lot of people sitting in church this morning, based on what I think Matthew is saying, is on the wide road. 1 John says, don't be deceived. Be one who is righteous, and that righteous one is one who does what he believes. Don't be deceived. And James picks up on that in verse 22 of chapter 1. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Just you're living under the power of the deceiver. Revelation says, you know, I know your deeds. You're lukewarm. You're not hot. You're cold. You're this lukewarm thing, and I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. You're useless. Wow, what a challenge. If we actually take this book seriously, not everyone in the church this morning will be a part of God's kingdom. Satan delights in the church's false claims of faith. James is speaking into that. He's writing to a group of people who say they're believers and really aren't. And he's saying, because your works prove that you are believing a false faith. It's not faith at all. George Whitefield was an evangelist in the late 1700s and just a very powerful speaker. And after a big event, he would speak to thousands and just have them gripped. And sometimes leaders would go to him and say, hey, so how many people did you convert? And he says, I don't know. We'll see in about 6 months. What a great answer. I don't know. A lot of them did this. A lot of them fell on the floor weeping, and I prayed with them a lot. But we'll see. We'll see in 6 months, in a year. We'll see what they do with it. Is it going to be a momentary conviction, or is this going to be truly faith? So James challenges us that belief united with action perfects the only faith that counts. Belief united together with action perfects, matures, brings to completion the only faith that matters, because that's really the only faith that there is. And so we as a church need to be gripped by this. This is really a passion of mine, that this place becomes full of people who have a genuine faith, and it's evidenced by their actions outside of this building. I heard a quote this week, or was it last week actually, a great quote, and I've been just kind of pondering it ever since. It said, you know, what we win someone by is what we win someone to. What we win someone by is what we win someone to. And I've been thinking about that. Because today the church movement, and I've quite frankly even been a part of it, creates this energized, perfected display of musicianship and oratory and all this stuff that just inspires people to a bunch of emotion. We put on a great show, and that's what we're winning someone by. And when we do that, that's what we're winning them to. That's the expectation of what the Christian life looks like. And so after a while, this extraordinary, awesome experience becomes very ordinary. And all of a sudden, we have to come up with a new gimmick to entertain and to captivate people and one that just convicts them to action when it's truly the gospel, the person of Jesus Christ, and a deep conviction that I am changed because I'm going to follow this guy. That is what my life is about. And if we call people to that, that's what we call them to. And so if we try to put on this great show and, hey, I'm all about excellence and doing things well, and, you know, there's some emotion in this, and that's okay. But if this is what we're calling people to, and this is what Brightview becomes, then this is all that we're calling them to be after. And so a passion of mine is for us to meet Jesus, be completely convinced that that is who he is, and that is the movement that he has started in this world. And we're coming alongside people who are hungry for something beyond themselves and say, hey, check this out. Follow me as I follow Jesus. And let's see the difference it's making. And so we're calling people to a genuine faith, a maturing faith, a perfecting faith, and it's a faith that is evidenced in action. And so that's what James is doing here. He's challenging us to do that. We're not our emotion, not just head knowledge that we understand all the big words, not just doing a bunch of scattered ministries, but we're truly following Jesus. This must have been a debate that the church that James is writing to was actually having, because we're going to see here that there's this discussion that goes on. And so we're going to see how there's this false dichotomy in the community's thinking, and it's actually very evident in most churches. In verse 18, so after he makes this great claim in verse 17, in the same way faith by itself is not accomplished or accompanied by action is dead, there's this pushback. He's quoting somebody who's kind of pushing back and objecting to that very powerful statement. And this person says, but you know, someone will say, you have faith and I have deeds. So he's driving this dichotomy. He's separating something that really shouldn't be separated. This might be confusing, this next couple of verses, but in Greek, there's no quotations. And so when a person has to translate it, we're trying to figure out who is saying what and when does that quotation end. And translations of James here struggles with that. And so if you're reading from a Bible that's similar to mine, you'll see that the quotations end halfway through verse 18. Some would say that it ends in verse 19, and I would probably jump on board with that. So my suggestion is that the whole of 18 and 19 is actually the voice of the objector, the one pushing back. Go ahead, Dorothy.
Can you please explain that?
Dichotomy. You did this last time, maybe, and I appreciate that. Yeah, dichotomy is something, a false dichotomy is when you dichotomize, you separate. You put in two different columns or distinctions, and they're actually sometimes put against each other or even cancel each other out. Depends what we're talking about. And it will come clear here in a second, but what James is picking up on is this whole concept of faith and action, faith and works. What do I do out of what I believe? And the whole discussion throughout history has been, how do I become saved? Is it just mere belief? Paul, Romans chapter 4, says it's by faith that you are justified. We're going to get to that in a second. And James says, well, in a minute, he's going to say, no, by what you do, you are justified. So we've got faith and actions, and we've wrestled between these two things for all of church history. And that's a dichotomy that's separating these two things, and they're distinct. It's a false dichotomy here. We see that these two things are interwoven, and they go together, and they can never be separated. And so that's what that word means. And we see that in the subjector. So James makes this powerful claim that you need to do something with your faith, and because if you don't, it's a dead faith anyway. And this person who's pushing back is saying this. And so I think the quotation goes all the way to 19 and doesn't end just with 18. So this is what the objector says. He says, you have faith and I have deeds. Show me your faith, James, without deeds, and I will show you my faith by what I do. You believe that there is one God. Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. So he's challenging James about this faith component, but he's going too far. He's swinging way over here and saying, yeah, but works is what really matters. I mean, demons believe that God exists. Well, what good is that? It's works. It's doing good things. And we're full of, the church is full of people that does great things. And that's great. But it's a false dichotomy. So this person, James, some people who follow James or go too far even with Paul, talk about cheap grace. That, you know, we can't do anything that ever can earn salvation. And I would agree with that. But it also creates this apathetic attitude that I'm just going to sit here and lean back and, well, I can't do anything anyway, so hey, pour it on, God. I believe that you're there, and just give it to me. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer came up with this concept of cheap grace. That's cheap. Just kind of taking it like you received a drink or something. That's cheap grace. It, you don't have to do anything because you know God did it all for you, and you have to all just understand that Jesus is real, and I accept the cross, and hey, I'm done. That's the conviction of many. It's cheap grace. The other side of that is what this objector is talking about. It's works righteousness. So doing something, I've got to earn this for myself, and probably most of us fall into this category. Let me give you an example. If there's an area of your life that you're struggling and sinning, and there's moments where you just kind of dive into it, you know what I'm talking about? There's that area that you just kind of grip by, and in moments of weakness, you just decide to go down that road. Whether it's a thought, it's an action, it's a word, it's a behavior, you know, whatever it is, you dive into that. And when you come out, you're just broken that you did that, and you just don't want that a part of your life. But we won't bring it to God right away, right? We want some time in there because we feel like, well, maybe if I do some good things for a while, then I can actually go to God and I'll feel more comfortable with it and ask for forgiveness then. As if that time of separation and doing other, maybe some good things, all of a sudden earns me the right to ask for forgiveness. Some of you are sitting here earning your salvation this morning because I'm a good churchgoer, or I've prayed a few times, or we all fall into works righteousness. I'm earning my righteousness by what I do. James is speaking into that, that it's not an either or. These things come together. The faith that counts is that was the one that we follow Jesus. In the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, we find the power and the presence and the favor and the love and the fulfillment that God promises. And if we want that, we don't do either of these things. We don't sit back and just kind of, hey, pour it on. I can't do anything to earn it anyway. Or we go about and try to earn it anyway. We practice and we believe in this inseparable unity, something that goes together. See, James now responds to this person who makes this big argument that, you know, I've got works and you've got faith. And he tries to separate these things. And James responds in 20, you are a foolish man. Do you want evidence that faith without deeds is useless? And he goes on to explain why. And so he's going to challenge the vain and empty, hollow understanding of this man that is what he wants to do is useless. Kind of what James is tapping into is this, is that many of us want the success or the status that comes with following Jesus without the commitment. You know, it's kind of like when those of us who had to propose. So if you're a man and you're married, you remember this moment. It's right about the time you're about to pass out. Anybody else remember that time? Okay. Now, okay, so I mean, I got down on one knee and I did that whole thing as, you know, will you be my wife? Yes. And of course, hopefully there's lots of waterworks and that's all happening. Now let's say after that, right away, you ask this question. Okay, what's the minimum requirement now for me to be a faithful husband? Can you imagine what that would do to the moment? That's exactly what we're doing. So often, when we come to God, and yes, you've gripped me, and I want this life with you, and I want all the beautiful things that come with it, what's the minimum requirement for me to have salvation? When Jesus says, are you with me or not? Are you going to follow me or not? It's the same thing. Now, if you did that, we're going to need to talk. But James says, no, that doesn't exist. That's not a covenant. That's not a marriage. That's not saving faith where you're wanting to receive the most for the least. Jesus is calling us to give all to receive all. And so James is challenging us to a faith that is a means of justification. He affirms Paul here. He's not contradicting Paul. In Romans chapter 4:22, so Paul says that by faith you have been justified. By faith you have been saved. And what he's talking about here is this priority of faith. That is through faith, believing in God, his promises, and trusting yourself to him and obeying him, that you receive salvation. Yes, James is not contradicting Paul. He's affirming Paul here. He's saying, yes, faith is the priority in your life. And faith is the basis for justification. So remember that word justification, standing before a judge, and we're standing there guilty, and God says, now because of Christ, you are not guilty. You are justified by your faith in Jesus. He's taken the cross for you, your punishment for you. You are just in my eyes. You are righteous. You are right in my eyes on the basis of your faith, the priority of your faith. But then James also goes on to talk about works, that it's the proof of justification. Okay? Means of justification is faith. Works is the proof of justification. In 21 to 25, he gives an example. So he calls this man foolish. He says, do you want evidence that faith without deeds is useless? It's empty. It's garbage. Verse 21, was not our ancestor of Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? I think verse 22 is the climax of this book. You see that his faith and his actions were working together. They were united. They were inseparable. They're together. They're working together. And his faith was made complete by what he did. That word complete actually doesn't just mean to fill to the brim of something, but it's actually an ongoing process of reaching an end. The verb in Greek is this idea of it's an ongoing continuousness of ushering something to its intended end, making it complete, fulfilled, perfected, matured. So his faith and his actions went together, making it complete. And so for Paul, priority of faith, but for James, the proof of faith. For Paul, faith is the basis of righteousness, the basis of justification. For James, works is the indicator, the proof of righteousness and justification. And so together, these things form one, an inseparable unity. Here's a picture that you could use. You know, if you have kids and you throw them in a dinghy with some oars, what do? They get dizzy, right? Because they do this one, and then they do this one. And they keep going around in circles, and it's kind of a picture of maybe how this could go together. One is faith and one is works. We live in a world that does good things, and they're spinning in one direction because they're working with works all the time. The problem is they look at the church and we have this intellectual understanding and belief of Jesus, but we don't do anything with it. And so we're just pulling on the other oar and we're just spinning in a new direction. And for a season they come in, they go, hey, this is a little different. We're going the other way. But they get kind of tired of that because it's still not getting them anywhere and they leave because they want to be a part of something beyond themselves. But when we engage these gifts that God has given us of faith in Jesus, the basis of our salvation, and then the means by which we can do it, we've got nothing to lose. We can do stuff. We can have an impact because I've got nothing to lose. The deceiver can't steal it from me, so I'm going to engage, and we start going somewhere. Churches haven't picked that up. Abraham did. His faith worked with actions to produce the mature faith that God intended. Verse 23, and the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God and was credited to him as righteousness, and he was called God's friend. That's salvation. That's salvation that's alive. Have you ever met somebody who truly has a genuine relationship with Jesus and just exudes out of them? They've tasted not just a friend with Jesus, he's my buddy, but this incredible covenant relationship with their Creator. And James paints that picture that Abraham had received that because he put his faith in action. Verse 24, you see that a person is justified, is authenticated by what he does and not faith alone. So faith and works are put together. They work together towards a perfect end. Belief translates into action, and that together brings about a unity with God that we're all looking for. That's faith that counts. So, if we actually went down this road, what would it look like? What kind of difference would this make in your life and the life of other people? Well, your maturity, if you chose to go down this road, your maturity inspires the next generation of game changers. The next generation of game changers. The job I did before this and before I went to school, I was a mobilizer for a mission organization. So my job was to actually interact with people considering going to the field. And so I traveled all over Alberta and spent a lot of time in Tim Hortons. And I sat and I talked and interviewed with people. And inevitably, in every conversation, when I asked, what got you here? Why you want to do this with your life? How has God informed this desire for you to go live in the jungle of Africa? Almost every time it was because a pastor, an elder, a Sunday school teacher, a mentor, a friend, a friend's parent, somebody set the example in their church. Somebody spoke into the life of that young person and said, hey, this is who you are. This is what you're capable of. Watch me. Hey, come with me. Inevitably, somebody was on the process of maturity before them, and they were completely inspired to be the next generation of game changers. And had I had more time this week, I was going to put their pictures up so you have a face to go alongside with some of these people. Some of them we are supporting as a church, by the way. And so, quite frankly, some of the younger ones here, or maybe some of the older ones, are looking to the rest of you saying, hey, inspire me. You've been here longer than I have. What does this really matter? Is this really true? Or are you just going the other way than me? And I'm kind of starting to get dizzy the other way. Are we moving to something? Show me the way. Is this true? Ian and Sipkia beat me to it. Friday night, we saw the next generation of game changers. We saw some of our young people work for weeks to put together a great night of honoring God, worshiping God, creating the context where the truth was proclaimed, where we just had fun. But there's game changers on that stage. There was one old guy, but he's not here to defend himself. So I'm going to this. But some of those are our young people. And some of them are there because some of you inspired them to get there and provided the opportunity for them to get there. And they're watching you. Some of you, they're there despite you. You might be that one that's just making Satan pleased. You might be that one that maybe he's feeling a little convicted. Hey, am I the pew warmer? Am I the one that might get sifted out in the end? God's doing his thing. He's inspiring the next generation of game changers. And I'm wondering what would happen if all of us became the mature believer. What would it look like if every young person, wherever we were, looked at that person and said, man, there's something different about them. Look what's coming out of their life. And I want to go talk to them and have you speaking to them. Hey, I've seen you around at the co-op or at school or on the ice rink or soccer field. And, hey, you got a great potential. I see this gift. And, hey, have you ever thought about doing? I'm here because somebody did that. Hey, Chris, have you ever thought about becoming a pastor? That's why I'm here. Your maturity can inspire the next generation of game changer. To do that, I want to challenge you to acknowledge that your life, your church involvement, your life at home, at work, on the sports field or rink or wherever you are, in co-op, or wherever you're going, your life is about life or death for people that watch you. This is about life or death. James says, faith without deeds is dead. The imagery is a corpse. And if you've ever been at a funeral or something like that, there's no breath, there's no pulse, there's no biological functions happening. It's dead. There's a coldness to that. And folks, your life is about life or death. Following Jesus is exactly about life. Doing the religious thing is exactly about death. And we have a choice to make. So many of us are kind of in a position that we'd follow this and believe this if actually Jesus showed up and kind of did his dramatic thing. Well, he said he's going to come again, but by that point, it's going to be too late. It's too late. That's why we have a revelation and a word and people to teach it that says, respond now, because there's going to be a time where you can't. Now, you don't want to be guilted into that or have this be a momentary conviction, but have something change inside you. Release whatever you grip by. And when you do that, this might be a little challenging for some of you, but then you'll actually live beyond the demons. This is going to challenge you. A few years ago, I had to preach out of one of the Gospels. It's written in many of the Gospels, but the account where Jesus encounters a man who's demon-possessed, and he cast the demons into the pigs. Remember that story? Do you remember what those demons said? Do you know how demons respond to God and to Jesus? Demons follow Jesus, if go with me for a second on this, better than most Christians do. Do you know why in the Gospels, the demons, when they encounter Jesus, they yell, you know, what do you want to do with me? Son of the living God. Son of the Most High. You are the Holy One of God. The demons proclaim the very essence and identity of Jesus when most of us won't even pray in front of our family for food. Most of us are terrified in a moment like this to give any kind of testimony of what happened through my week. Give any kind of testimony that we haven't had to face death on our streets from day in, day out. Yet the demons, on first encounter with Jesus, will proclaim his identity as the Son of the Most High God. That hit me when I had to preach that passage. And this was a challenge that I gave to that church, that, you know what, folks, we need to live beyond the demons. What's the difference between a true follower of Jesus and you know, the demons in the story, other than they're demons and we're people? But what's the difference? Submission. Submission. The person pushing back to James is right. Even the demons believe in God. Yeah, he's right. The difference between a believer and the demon is submission. That I not only call who he is, but I actually give him my life, so that what I do is consistent with what I believe. So if you're a person who can't even pray in front of your wife or your husband, you can't set an example for your kids, you can't even come into a room where you're completely safe and speak anything about the God that you say you follow, let alone tell anybody at work. You need to release control of your life. Accept God's plan for your life. Sacrifice the plans for your life and your pride and everything that you're holding on to, and commit it to him so that you follow him and live beyond the demons. When you do that, you can start to discover God's narrow path for you. You know, we had a dump of snow, and if you're a grandparent or a parent with some young kids, it's always kind of funny to see them jump into it. And what happens? They get swallowed up. They don't know where to go. They don't have the strength to go. And so as a parent, if we're going to walk to the playground or whatever, what do? We go in front of them, and we plow the narrow road to where they need to go. Well, our Father's done that. It's called Scripture. It's called the Kingdom Movement. It's called leaders who've gone before you. It's called the Spirit speaking to you. There's a narrow path for you. And when you start to submit your life, it's amazing how God starts to speak to you and say, this is what I have for you. This is what we're doing as a church. Hey, God, what's the narrow path that you have for Brightview? And give us the strength to follow it and live beyond the demons. So discover that narrow path. Some questions. Maybe this will help you. Who did God interrupt you with this week? What person walked into your life and disrupted and maybe, you know, became that barrier to you, what you thought you were going to do this week? But who's that person that God brought into your office or whatever that, you know, you thought was just a distraction? What's that circumstance, that opportunity that you avoided because you were fearful or too prideful to take? You know, why are you here this morning? What are you looking for? Why do you have the family that you have? Why are you in the life phase that you are? Why do you have the friends that you do? Why are you in the place of work that you are? Why are you not working maybe for this season? You know, what battle are you facing, and what is God trying to teach you? I can't wait for Marion to come back and have more of you interact with her, because, man, they have a testimony of what this battle has been for them. Why does God bring these things into our life? Well, he's trying to show you the narrow way. You look at Abraham, Moses, Elijah, Esther, Jesus, Paul, Barnabas, Peter, James. All of these guys had all of these things happen that provided for them the narrow way. mature faith, authentic faith, complete faith, fulfilling faith, perfect faith, all of these things, when they happen, reveal the true colors when we're tested. But for many of us, when these challenges come, they just expose our stagnancy. And we're really not doing anything. So start looking for the narrow way, and then go there. Go there. Go. Get going. James Whitefield, or sorry, George Whitefield, again, the evangelist, he said one day when he started getting older, and at that time was about 55, but someone went to him and was talking about, you know, how are you doing? Are you going to make it? And he said, you know, I'd rather wear out than rust out. And I want to challenge you to not just sit here and start rusting as your life continues on. Wear out. Wear out. And if you don't know what that looks like, call somebody who's gone there before you into your life. I'm going to leave you with one story that really impacted me. I think I've told it here before, but it's been a while. Some of you are new, so I want to tell this story to you. This was a phrase that impacted me, and it ultimately got me here. In 2002, Myrna and I went down to Mexico as sponsors, and one of the speakers there was a guy named Brad Buser. He was a missionary to an unreached people group in Papua New Guinea, and he told this story. It had a huge impact on us. Where they lived, there was an airstrip, and with the monsoons and stuff like that, and just the rainy weather, eventually the drainage ditches on either side would get filled in. With earth and grass and all that kind of stuff. And after a while, the airfield wouldn't drain properly. So every year, he told his kids, hey, it's time to go dig the ditch. And he said, okay, so let's say my kids at that time said, you know what, Dad? We are going to go take a course on ditch digging. We're going to become equipped. We're going to get a lot of head knowledge. We're going to understand all the equipment to do. We're going to really understand every technique to dig a ditch. Or he said, you know what, Dad, we decided we're going to call a bunch of people together and we're going to pray over the ditch. We're going to pray that it's cleaned out and that it doesn't grow anymore and all this kind of stuff. But we're going to have a big prayer vigil about the ditch. Or he says, you know, we're going to go lay hands on the ditch and maybe the ditch will be healed and it will all kind of be cleaned out. I mean, do you see where I'm getting at? That's exactly what we do. God says, I've given you a mission to do. Go do it. Dig the ditch. And that just impacted me for so long. A guy who's grown up in a Christian home and had great Christian mentors and a great Christian church, who's got education, all these opportunities, who've been sitting here rusting out rather than wearing out. And that phrase just hit me so hard that when I got home and I went through another year of teaching, this was my screensaver. And I had kid after kid coming up to my desk saying, what does that mean? And eventually it led us to the long road that we've been on. Dig the ditch. And so I want to challenge you that are you rusting out or are you wearing out? Do you have an apathetic faith that really leads to death, or you have a maturing, perfecting faith that is being, you know, that's having an impact through what you do? Are you digging your ditch? I hope so. Let's pray. And I'd like you to take a moment and ask God, what is the narrow way that you have for me? And give me the strength and the boldness to dig the ditch. And we'll close. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the challenge of James. There is no conflict between him and Paul and really what salvation is about. We do come to you with nothing. We come to you with a genuine belief that Jesus is real and he paved the way for us to follow. And if we take the Bible seriously, there are significant consequences with playing with that, doing our religious thing, that we'll be spat out of your mouth, that we will be sifted out. What we build will fall down. The foundation upon we've built will wash away. We are that seed that has maybe taken root for a while, but it's been burned or choked out. Not everyone sitting in church this morning around the world will be a part of your kingdom movement in the future. I think Satan is delighting in the apathy and the stagnancy of the Western church in particular. And God, it makes me nauseous to think that that's what we would become. I pray that we would be deeply convicted about what we believe and how it is united inseparably with what we do. What we do beyond today, this isn't church. This is us going out or being inspired to go out and be the church through our actions and our words and our testimonies. You know, what do people see when they look at me and listen to me day in and day out? Do they see a follower of Jesus or a religious person who's on a wide road to destruction? I pray that we would understand death for what it is. And when we do, we see the life of Jesus for what it really is. May we be deeply convicted to follow that. Thank you for the example of Abraham and countless generations of people gone before us, and how many of us are here this morning because those whose maturing faith has gone before us has inspired us to be the next generation of game changers. And I don't care what age we are, we can be the next generation of game changers. And I pray that these people here this morning, their investment into you would inspire them to grow in their faith and mature in their faith, so that one day you will reveal to us whose life we've impacted, how we've contributed to this kingdom movement. And God, we'd hear those great words from you. Well done. You've done well. You've done good. And so inspire us here this morning to dig our ditch. I don't know what that is for each person here. The hard work starts now. And so I just pray that they'd understand the significance of their life. It's about life or death. They would truly surpass the demons by submitting their life to you. That they would find the road that you have already paved for them through the deep. And then, God, they'd go there. They'd just embrace it. They'd get their hands dirty. They'd get wet. They'd get smelly. They'd get stinky. They'd get bruised and cut. But we know the vision that we work towards. And so I just pray that you inspire them this morning to dig the ditch. Thank you that you followed, you provided the way for us that we can follow. Just give us the strength here this morning to live it out beyond this hour. Thank you for these people and this time and the power of your word. I pray this in Jesus' name.